Did you see the fineness of their clothing? The wagons they created? You cannot fight that. I cannot fight that. But together we could fight that. There are tens of thousands of listeners around the plains. When the humans return, let us show them a united nation, not a bunch of squabbling tribes. She gestured to the other warforms, then let her gaze linger on Sherifel in his shard plate. We won't fight you today, Eshonai said, turning back to the enemy family. None of this family will fight you today. But if any of you persist, you will personally discover the true might of this form. We are going to approach the Living Songs family next. You may choose to be the first to join with our new nation and be recognized for your wisdom for generations. Or you can be left until the end to come groveling for membership once our union is nearly complete. She hefted her spear and threw it, shocking herself with the power behind that throw. It soared over the enemy family and disappeared far into the distance. She heard more than one of them humming to the rhythm of the terrors. She nodded to the others, and they joined her, marching into the city. A few seemed annoyed. They wanted a battle to test their abilities. She'd never known listeners to be bloodthirsty, and she didn't feel this form had changed her that much. But she did admit she felt a certain eagerness. We should train, she said to the others. Work out some of our aggression.
That sounds wonderful, Thude said.
As long as we can do it in front of everyone else, Melu said to irritation. I'd like them to understand how easily I could have cracked their skulls. She looked to Eshonai. But that was well done. I guess I'm glad I didn't have to rip anyone apart.
How did you learn to give speeches? One of the others asked from behind. Did you learn that talking to those trees out in the wilderness?
I'm not a hermit, Dolimid, she said to irritation. I just like the idea of being free, of not being locked into one location. As long as we don't know what is out there, we're likely to be surprised. Tell me, would we be scrambling now to get our people in order if we'd simply explored our surroundings? We could have been preparing to face the humans for generations if we hadn't been so afraid. The others hummed to consolation, understanding. Why had Eshonai had so much trouble persuading people before? Was her present ease because of the connection she felt with these listeners, the first war forms? There was so much to learn from this form, so much to experiment with. She felt a spring in her step. Perhaps this would be a better form for exploration. She could leap obstacles, run faster. There was so much possibility. They entered the city. Her family's warriors, those who had been throwing their spears outside, trotting in with them, immediately accepting the authority of the warforms. As they passed Sherifel's hut, she saw Venli again, lurking in the shadows. This was her victory, after a fashion. Eshonai probably should have gone to congratulate her, but couldn't bring herself to do it. Venli didn't need more songs praising her. She already had a big enough ego. Instead, Eshonai led the group to the storm shelter, where the rest of their family was emerging. Each and every one deserved to see the new form up close. 69. Pure Tones of Roshar. I leave you now to your own company. From Rhythm of War, page 27. Navani hit the tuning fork and touched it to a glowing diamond. When she pulled it away from the gemstone, a tiny light of stormlight followed behind it, and when she touched the fork to an empty diamond, the stormlight flowed into it. The transfer would continue as long as the fork made the second diamond vibrate.
Sometimes I think of it like a gas, she thought, taking notes on the speed of the flow. And sometimes a liquid. I keep wavering between the two, trying to define it. But it must be neither one. Stormlight is something else, with some of the properties of both a liquid and a gas. After completing this control experiment, and timing how quickly the stormlight flowed, she set up the real experiment. She did this inside a large steel box her scholars had created for dangerous experiments, sole cast into shape, with a thick glass window at one end. She'd forced the enemy to drag it in from the hallway outside, then place it on top of her desk. She wasn't certain if this would save her from a potential explosion, but since the box didn't have a top, the force of the destruction should go upward, and as long as she stayed low and watched through the window, it should shield her. It was the best she could do in these difficult circumstances. She told the singers she was taking normal precautions and tried not to indicate to them that she expected an explosion. And indeed she didn't. The sphere that had killed her scholars had not been void light, but something else. Something Navani didn't yet understand. She was convinced that mixing void light and stormlight wouldn't create an explosion, but a new kind of light, like tower light. She began this next experiment the same way as the previous one, drawing out stormlight and sending it toward another diamond. Then she reached into the box with tongs and placed a void light diamond in the center of the flow, between the stormlight diamond and the tuning fork. The stormlight didn't react to the void light diamond at all. It simply streamed around the dark gemstone and continued to the vessel diamond. As the tuning fork's tone quieted, the stream weakened. When the fork fell silent, the stormlight hanging in the air between the two diamonds puffed away and vanished. Well, she hadn't expected that to do anything. Now for a better test. She'd spent several days working under a singular hypothesis that if stormlight reacted to a tone, void light and tower light would as well. She'd needed to take a crash course in music theory to properly test the idea. The Alethi traditionally used a 10-note scale, though it was more accurately 2 5-note quintuves. This was right and orderly, and the greatest and most famous compositions were all in this scale. However, it wasn't the only scale in use around the world. There were dozens. The Thalens, for example, preferred a 12-note scale, a strange number, but the 12 steps were mathematically pleasing. In researching the tone the tuning fork created, she'd discovered something incredible. Anciently, people had used a 3-note scale, and a few of the compositions remained. The tone that drew stormlight was the first of the 3 notes from this ancient scale. With some effort, it had required sending Fuse to Kolinar through the Oath Gate to raid the Royal Music Conservatory. She'd obtained tuning forks for the other 2 notes in this scale. To her delight, Voidlight responded to the 3rd of the 3 notes. She hadn't been able to find any indication in her reading that people had once known these 3 notes correlated to the 3 ancient gods. No Alethi scholars seemed to know that one of these tones could prompt a reaction in stormlight, though Raboniel had, upon questioning, said she'd known. Indeed, she'd been surprised to learn that Navani had only recently discovered the pure tones of Roshar, as she called them. Navani had tried singing the proper tones, but hadn't been able to make the light respond. Perhaps she couldn't match the pitch well enough, because Raboniel had been able to do it, singing and touching 1 gemstone, then moving her finger to another while holding the note. The stormlight had followed her finger just as it did a tuning fork. Today, Raboniel was off tending to other tasks, but Navani could use the tuning forks to replicate her singing ability. 3 tones, a note for honor, a note for odium, and a note for cultivation. Yet Voronism only worshipped the Almighty, honor. Theology would have to wait for another time. For now, she set up her next experiment. She created streams of stormlight and voidlight, drawing each out from a diamond in a corner of her box, and crossed the streams at the center. The two lights pushed upon one another and swirled as they met, but then separated and streamed to their separate forks. "All right," Navani said, writing in her notebook. "What about this?" She picked up the partially empty voidlight diamond and then brought out a fresh stormlight diamond, fully infused. In Fabril science, you captured a spren by creating a gemstone with a kind of vacuum in it. You drew out the stormlight, leaving a sphere with a void or suction inside. It would then pull in a nearby spren, which was made of light. It was like any pressure differential. She hoped to be able to refill the voidlight sphere with stormlight now that a portion of the voidlight had been removed. She hit the tuning fork, started the stormlight streaming out of its diamond, then tried to get it to go into the voidlight diamond by making it vibrate to the fork's tone. Unfortunately, when she touched the tuning fork to the voidlight diamond, it immediately stopped vibrating and the tone died, extinguished like a candle doused with water. She was able to get the stormlight to bunch up against the voidlight diamond by putting the fork next to it, but when she got the voidlight to stream out toward the side of the table, theoretically creating an active pressure differential in that diamond, she couldn't get it to suck stormlight in. Only once all of the voidlight was out could she infuse the diamond with stormlight. "Like oil and water indeed," she said, making notes. Yet the way the streams didn't repel one another when touching felt like proof they weren't opposites. She rose and, after noting the results of this experiment, went to talk to the sibling. Navani could easily fool the guards into thinking she was simply strolling among the bookshelves to read a passage or two, as she often did this. Today she began picking through the books on the back shelf, while resting her hand on the sibling's vein in the wall. "Are we being watched?" Navani asked. "I've told you," the sibling said. "Void Spren can't be invisible in the tower. That protection is different from the ones suppressing enemy surge binders, and Raboniel hasn't corrupted it yet. You also told me you could sense if a void spren was near." "Yes." "So, are any near?" "No," the sibling said. "You do not trust my word?" "Let's just call it a healthy paranoia on my part," Navani said. "Tell me again of—" "You continue to experiment with Fabrials," the sibling interrupted. "We need to talk more about that. I do not like what you've been doing." "I haven't captured any more spren," Navani whispered. "I've been working with stormlight and voidlight." "Dangerous work. The man who forges weapons can claim he's never killed, but he still prepares for the slaughter." "If we're going to restore your abilities, I need to understand how light works. So unless you have a better idea for me to do this, I'm going to have to continue to use gemstones and, yes, Fabrials." The sibling fell silent. "Tell me again about tower light," Navani said. "This is growing tedious. Do you want to be saved or not?" "Fine. Tower light is my light. The light I could create." "Did you need a bondsmith to make it?" "No, I could make it on my own. And my bondsmith could create it through their bond with me. And that light, in turn, powered the tower's defenses." "Not only the defenses, everything. Why does it no longer work?" I already explained that.
This is a common investigative method, Navani said calmly, flipping through her book with her left hand. My goal is to make you restate facts in different ways, leading you to explain things differently, or to remember details you forgot.
I haven't forgotten anything. The defenses no longer work because I don't have the light for them. I lost most of my strength when I lost the ability to hear the two pure tones of Roshar. I can make only a tiny amount of light, enough to power a few of the tower's basic fabrials.
Two tones of Roshar? Navani said. There are three.
No, there are two. One from my mother, one from my father. The tone of Odium is an interloper. False.
Could part of the reason you lost your abilities relate to that tone becoming a pure tone of Roshar? Odium truly becoming one of the three gods?
I don't know, the sibling admitted.
Navani noted this hypothesis.
We need to find a way to restore my tower light, the sibling said, and remove the void light from my system.
And that, Navani said, is exactly what I'm working on. If she could figure out how to combine two lights, then it would be the first step toward creating tower light. She clearly needed an emulsifier, a facilitator. What kind of emulsifier could stick to stormlight and make it mix with void light? She shook her head, taking her hand off the vein on the wall. She'd been here too long, so she took a book and strolled to the front of the room, lost in thought. However, as she reached her desk, she found a small box waiting for her. She glanced at the guard by the door, who nodded. Raboniel had sent it. Navani opened the box, breathless, and found a brightly glowing diamond. At first glance, it seemed to be another stormlight sphere, but as she held it up and placed it next to a true one, she could see the green tinge to the one Raboniel had sent. Lifelight. She'd promised to get some for Navani. Did she say how she acquired this? Navani asked. The guard shook his head. Navani had a guess. The sibling had lost sight of Lift, but had explained something was odd about that girl. Something Navani held as a hope that might get them out of this. Hands steady, though anticipation spren shot up around her, Navani used the middle tuning fork on this new diamond. And it worked. She was able to draw lifelight out and send it streaming into a gemstone. Towerlight was lifelight and stormlight combined, so perhaps lifelight, the light of cultivation, had some property that allowed it to mix with other lights. Holding her breath, Navani repeated her earlier experiments, except with lifelight instead of voidlight. She failed. She couldn't get stormlight and lifelight to mix. No use of tuning forks, no touching of the streams or clever use of gemstone differentials worked. She tried mixing void light and life light. She tried mixing all three. She tried every experiment she'd listed in her brainstorming sessions earlier. Then she did them all again, until, because each experiment allowed a little life light to vanish into the air, she'd used it all up. Shooing away exhaustion spren, she stood, frustrated. Another dead end. This was as bad as the morning's experiments, when she'd tried everything she could think of, including using two tuning forks at once, to make Towerlight move from its gemstone. She'd failed at that as well. She gathered all the used diamonds and deposited them by the door guard to be picked up and reinfused. There was a high storm coming today. After that, she paced, frustrated. She knew she shouldn't let the lack of results bother her. Real scientists understood that experiments like this weren't failures. They were necessary steps on the way to discovery. In fact, It would have been remarkable and completely unconventional to find a good result so early in the process. The problem was, scientists didn't have to work under such terrible deadlines or pressures. She was isolated, each moment ticking them closer to disaster. The only lead she had was in trying to mix the lights, in the hope that she could eventually create more tower light to help the sibling. She wandered the room, pretending to inspect the spines of books on the shelves. If I make my discovery, Raboniel will know, since a guard is always watching. She'll force the answer out of me, and so even in these attempts to escape, I'm furthering her goals, whatever those are. Navani was on the cusp of something important. The revelations she'd been given about Stormlight fundamentally changed their understanding of it and the world at large. Three types of power. The possibility they could be blended, and possibly something else, judging by that strange sphere that warped the air around it. Her instinct said that this knowledge would come out eventually, and the ones who controlled it, exploited it, would be the ones who won the war. I need another plan, she decided. If she did discover how to make tower light, and if the shield did fall, Navani needed a way to isolate the crystal pillar for a short time, to defend it, perhaps to work on it. Navani gripped her notebook in her safe hand to appear as if she were writing down the titles of books. Instead, she quickly took notes on an idea. She'd been told she could have anything she needed, so long as it was relevant to her experiments. They also let her store equipment out in the hallway. So, what if she created some fabrile weapons, then stored them in the hallway? Innocent-looking fabrials that, once activated, could be used to immobilize guards or fused, coming to stop her from working on the pillar. She sketched out some ideas, traps she could create using seemingly innocent fabrile parts, pain rails to administer agony and cause the muscles to lock up, heating fabrials to burn and scald. Yes, she could create a series of defenses in the form of failed experiments, then store them haphazardly in crates along the hallway. She could even arm them by using Voidspren gems, as she could demand those for use in her experiments. These plans soothed her. This was something meaningful she could do. However, the experiments and their potential still itched at her. What was Raboniel's true goal? Was it to make a weapon herself? Like the one that had destroyed the room and Navani's two scientists? A few hours had passed, so it wouldn't look strange if she went to the back of the stacks again. She picked up a book and settled down in a chair she'd placed nearby. Although she wasn't directly visible to the guard, she pretended to read as she reached her hand to the wall and touched the vein. Any spren nearby? Navani asked. I cannot feel any, the sibling said with a resigned tone. Good. Tell me, do you know anything of the explosion that happened on the day of the invasion? It involved two of my scientists in a room on the fifth floor. I felt it. But I do not know what caused it. Have you ever heard of a sphere or a light that warps the air around it? One that appears to be void light, unless you look at it long enough to notice the warping effect? No, the sibling said. I've never heard or seen anything like that, though it sounds dangerous. Navani considered, tapping her finger against the wall. I haven't been able to get any of the lights to mix. Do you know of any potential binding agent that could make them stick together? Do you know how tower light is mixed from storm light and life light? They don't mix, the siblings said. They come together as one. Like I am a product of my mother and father, so tower light is a product of me. And stop asking me the same questions. I don't care about your investigative methods. I've told you what I know. Stop making me repeat myself.
Navani took a deep breath, calming herself with effort.
Fine. Have you been able to eavesdrop on Raboniel at all? Not much. I can only hear things near a few people that are relevant. I can see the Wind Runner. I think the Edge Dancer has been surrounded by Ralkalest, which is why she's invisible. Also, I can see one particular regal. Any ideas on why that is? No. Regals weren't often in the tower in the past, and never this variety. She can speak all languages. Perhaps this is why I can see near her. Though she vanishes sometimes, so I cannot see all she does. I can also see near the crystal pillar, but with the field set up, I hear mere echoes of what is happening outside.
Tell me those, then.
It's nothing relevant. Raboniel is trying her own experiments with the light, and she hasn't gotten as far as you have. This seems to frustrate her.
Curious. That did a little for Navani's self-esteem.
She really wants this hybrid light. I wonder, maybe Fabriel's made with a hybrid stormlight void light would work in the tower, even if the protections were turned against her again. Maybe that is why she wants it. You are foolish to presume to know what one of the fused wants. She is thousands of years old. You can't outthink her.
You'd better hope that I can. Navani flipped a few pages in her notebook.
I've been thinking of other ways out of this. What if we found you someone to bond, to make them radiant? We could—
No!
Never again! Hear me out, Navani said. You've said you'll never bond a human again because of the things we do to Spren. But what about a singer?
Could you theoretically bond one of them?
We are talking of resisting them, and now you suggest I bond one? That seems insane.
Maybe not, Navani said. There's a Parshendi in Bridge 4. I've met him, and Kaladin has vouched for him. He claims that his people rejected the fused long ago. What about him? Not a human. Not someone who has ever created a Fabriel. Someone who knows the rhythms of Roshar. The sibling was silent, and Navani wondered if the conversation was over.
Sibling? She asked. I had not considered this, they said. A singer who does not serve Odium? I will need to think. It would certainly surprise Raboniel, who thinks that I am dead or sleeping. In any case, I cannot form a bond now with the protections up. I would need him to touch my pillar. What if I had him here? Navani said. Ready to try when the shield falls? And with some distractions in place to give you time to talk to him? I cannot form a bond with just anyone, the sibling said. In the past, I spent years evaluating bondsmith squires to select one who fit me exactly. Even they eventually betrayed me, though not as badly as other humans.
Can we really afford pickiness right now?
It's not pickiness. It's the nature of Spren and the bond. The person must be willing to swear the correct oaths, to unite instead of divide. They must mean it, and the oaths must be accepted. It is not simply a matter of throwing the first person you find at me. Beyond that, since I cannot create tower light, they will not be able to either. A bond would do nothing unless we solve the problems with my powers. It would be better if you focused on that problem instead.
Fine, Navani said, sensing an opening.
But I need time to research all of this. It is difficult to work while feeling I have a knife to my neck. If I knew the nodes were being defended, that would take the pressure off me. Tell me where one of them is. I have a list here of plans to protect it. I can read them off to you. The sibling was silent, so Navani continued. We can have Kaladin start searching, loudly and obviously, on a different level, leading the enemy on a chase in the wrong direction. In the meantime, while they're distracted, we could sneak up to the node and reinforce its defenses. We have some creme that hasn't hardened yet, kept wet in the tower stores. We could seal up the node location entirely, maybe run the creme through with some training sheaths for shard blades, so it would be extra difficult to cut. That could earn us hours to get troops in to defend it, if it does get discovered. Or, if I knew where one of the nodes was, I might be able to have Kaladin begin infusing it with more stormlight. That might counteract the void light that Raboniel has used on you. If she can corrupt you through a node, could we not perhaps cleanse you through one? I think it's worth trying, because my efforts to create tower light are stalled. She waited, gripping her pad tightly. Her other ideas were sketchier than those. She wouldn't use them unless these arguments didn't work. So good with words. Humans are like persuasion, Spren. I can't speak with one of you without being changed. Navani continued to wait. Silence was best now. Fine, the sibling said. One of the two remaining nodes is in the well at the center of the place you call the Breakaway Market. It is near other Fabrials there. One hidden among many. On the first floor? Navani asked. That's such a populated area. All of the nodes are down low. There was talk of installing others farther away, but my bondsmith did not have the resources. My falling out with the humans was driving them away. The project wasn't completed. Only the four on the first few floors were completed. Navani frowned. Though the well was a clever place to hide a Fabrial, many of the workings of the tower remained mysterious to modern scholars. So a cluster of gemstones working as pumps might indeed camouflage another Fabrial. In fact, Navani had studied drawings of those pumps herself. Had this mechanism been there, unnoticed, all along? This is a good node for your agent to visit, the sibling said, because it can be reached from the back ways. Have your wind runner visit it through the aquifers, and we will see if, by infusing it with stormlight, he can counteract the corruption. It might not work, as I am not simply of honor or of cultivation. But it could help. And the final node? Navani asked. Is mine alone, the sibling replied. Show me that your work on this one helps, human, and then we can speak further. A fair compromise, Navani said. I am willing to listen, sibling. She left the wall and grabbed some books to read to cover what she'd been doing. And she did need to study more, after all. She'd have loved to have more books on music theory, but this archive didn't have anything more specific on the topic. She did have Calamy's notes about the gemstones they'd discovered that used certain buzzing vibrations as substitutes for letters. Perhaps those would help. She was browsing through those notes, walking idly among the stacks, when she saw the sibling's light flashing. She hurried over, nervous about how bright the light was. She glanced at the guard, hoping he hadn't seen, and put her hand to the wall. You need to... They've found the node in the well. We're too late. What? Already? I am as good as dead. Contact Kaladin. They already have the node, and he's too far away. We contact Kaladin, Navani said. Now, I'll find a way to distract Raboniel.
70. Well. Opposites. Opposites of sounds. Sound has no opposite. It's merely overlapped vibration. The same sound, but sound has meaning. This sound does, at least. These sounds. The voices of gods. From Rhythm of War, final page. Kaladin awoke to something dark attacking him. He screamed, struggling against the clinging shadows. They'd been assaulting him for an eternity, wrapping around him, constricting him. Voices that never relented, fingers of shadow that drilled into his brain. He was in a dark place full of red light, and the shadows laughed and danced around him. They tormented him, flayed him, stabbed him again and again, and wouldn't let him die. He fought back the hands that gripped. Then he crawled across the floor, pulling up against the wall and breathing shallowly. The rushing sounds of his own blood in his ears drowned out the laughter. One shadow continued watching him. One terrible shadow. It stared at him, then turned and took something from beside the wall before vanishing. Vanishing out the door. Kaladin blinked, and the shadows melted from his mind. The terrible laughter, the phantom pain, the whispers. His mind always interpreted those as Moash's voice. A nightmare. Another nightmare.
Kaladin?
Syl asked. She sat on the floor in front of him. He blinked, glancing sharply one way, then the other. The room had settled into place. Teft sleeping on the stone bench, a few chips set out for light. Fierce Bren like globs of goo undulating in the corners. He swallowed, his mouth dry. I had a nightmare.
I know.
He carefully relaxed his posture, embarrassed at how he must appear huddled up by the wall, like a child frightened of the dark. He couldn't afford to be a child. Too much depended on him. He stood up, his clothing sweaty.
What time is it? Midday,
she said. My schedule is completely off. He tried to pull himself together as he stepped over to get a drink, but he stumbled and caught himself on the ledge. He had to grip it tightly as the nightmare threatened to resurface. Stormfather. This was the most oppressive one yet.
Kaladin?
Syl said. He took a long drink, then froze. His spear was gone from beside the door. What happened? He demanded, slamming the tin cup down harder than he'd intended. Where is my spear?
The sibling contacted us, she said, still sitting on the floor. That's why Dabit tried to wake you. Another note has been found. Inside the well in the market. The enemy is there already.
Storms, Kaladin said. We need to go. He reached for Navani's fabrial and his pouch of gems. He found the latter, but the fabrial was gone. Dabid? Kaladin demanded.
You were huddled there muttering,
Syl said, finally lifting into the air.
And you didn't seem to be able to see me. The sibling is terrified. I could hear them while sitting on Dabid's shoulder. And so...
Kaladin grabbed the bag of gems and dashed out of the room, Syl following as a ribbon of light. He caught up with Dabit at the first stairwell, just two hallways over. The shorter bridgeman stood with the spear and fabrial held close to his chest, staring down with a panicked expression. He jumped as he saw Kaladin, then let out a long, relieved sigh. Kaladin took the fabrial. You were going to try to stop the fused, Kaladin said, because I didn't get up. Dabit nodded. Dabit, you barely know how to use a spear, Kaladin said, quickly strapping on the fabrial. He'd had only 4 days of practice with the device. It would have to be enough. Dabit didn't respond, of course. He helped Kaladin strap the fabrial on, then held out the spear. Kaladin took it, then gave the Bridge Four salute. Dabit returned it. Then, remarkably, said something in a voice soft and gravelly.
Life before death.
Storms. Those were the first words Kaladin had ever heard from the man. He grinned, gripping Dabit by the shoulder. Life before death, Dabit. Dabit nodded. There wasn't time for more. Kaladin turned away from the stairwell and began running again. Screams from the nightmare echoed in his head, but he didn't have time for weakness. He had to stop the corruption of that gemstone, and barring that, he had to destroy the node. That was the only way to buy Navani the time she needed. He had to get there quickly, which meant he couldn't use the stairs. He'd have to go straight down through the atrium.
"I need to see the Lady of Wishes immediately," Navani proclaimed to the guard. "I've made a discovery of incalculable value. It cannot wait for..." The guard, a regal storm form, simply started walking and gestured for her to follow. He didn't even need the full explanation. "Excellent," Navani said, joining him in the hallway. "I'm glad you see the urgency." The guard walked her to the large stairwell that led up to the ground floor. A deepest one stood here, her fingers laced before her.
"What is it?"
she asked, in heavily accented Alethi.
"A sudden illness?"
"No," Navani said, taken aback. "A discovery. I think I found what the Lady of Wishes was searching for."
"But of course, you can't share it with anyone but Raboniel herself," the fused said, a faintly amused rhythm to her voice.
"Well, I mean," Navani trailed off.
"I'll see if I can reach her via Spanreed," the fused said. "I'll tell her it is most urgent."
Storms. They were expecting an attempted distraction from Navani. That thought was reinforced as the fused glided to a cabinet that had been set up by the wall. She carefully but slowly selected a span reed from the collection stored there. It was a reverse distraction. They'd known Navani would attempt something like this, but how had they known that she would know that? She stepped back, her eyes widening as the terrible implications struck her. Kaladin was in serious danger.
Barefoot and armed with a spear, Kaladin burst out onto the walkway across the atrium, then hurled himself out into the open space, 11 stories in the air. Full of stormlight, hoping it would save him in case this didn't work, he pointed his hand directly beneath him and engaged Navani's Fabriel. As soon as it was activated, he lurched to a halt in the air, hovering, his muscles straining as he was basically doing a handstand with one hand. But as long as the counterweight in the distant shaft was held motionless, Kaladin would be as well. He gripped the bar across his left hand and began to fall downward, almost as if he were lashed. In fact, he was counting on it seeming like nothing was wrong with his powers, that he was a full windrunner ready for battle. He wouldn't be able to keep up such a facade for long, but perhaps it would gain him an advantage. His descent, at a speed a notch below insane, gave him a view out the enormous atrium window, running all the way up the wall to his right. Strangely, it was dark outside, though Syl had said it was midday. He didn't have to ask for clarification, as a flash of lightning bespoke the truth. A high storm. He still found it incredible that he could be so deep within a tower that one could be going on without him realizing it. Even in the best storm shelters, you usually felt the rumbles of thunder or the anger of the wind. His fall certainly drew attention. Heavenly ones, dressed in long robes, turned from their mid-air meditations. Shouts rose from regals or singers along the various levels. He wasn't certain if Leshui was among them or not, as he passed too quickly. Using the Fabriel, he slowed himself before he hit the ground, then deactivated the device entirely and fell the last 5 feet or so. Stormlight absorbed that drop, and he startled dozens of people, many of them human, who hadn't heard the disturbance above. Commerce was now allowed and encouraged by the fused, and the atrium floor had become a secondary market, though a more transient one than the breakaway a short distance off. That was where he would find the well. Kaladin's luminescence would be starkly visible against the dark window, lit in flashes. The shouts of alarm above were swallowed in the voluminous atrium as Kaladin oriented himself, then ran for a stack of crates. He took a few steps up to launch into the air, some 10 feet high, then he pointed his left hand and engaged Navani's device. He flew like a windrunner, his body upright, left arm held at chest height, elbow bent. It might look like he was using lashings. The windrunners sometimes dove and flew headfirst like they were swimming. Just as often they would fly standing up straight, like he did now. He did tuck his legs up as he went soaring over the heads of the people who ducked. Sills zipped along beside him, imitating a storm cloud. People cried out, surprised, but also excited, and Kaladin worried about what he was showing them. He didn't want to inspire a revolt that would get hundreds killed. The best he could hope for was to get in, destroy the Fabril, and get out alive. That goal whispered of a much larger problem. Navani had said there were 4 nodes. Today, he'd try to destroy the 3rd. At this rate, the last one would fall in a few days, and then what? He pushed that thought out of his mind as he flew along the top of a corridor, inches from the textured stone ceiling. He didn't have time for second-guessing or for dwelling on the crippling darkness and anxiety that continued to scratch at his mind. He had to ignore that, then deal with the effects later, exactly as he'd been doing far too long now. "Watch for an ambush," he told Syl as they burst from the corridor and into the breakaway market. This large room, truly cavernous, was 4 stories high and packed with shops along the ground. Many were along roadways that Navani, reluctantly adapting to the will of the people, had laid out in the way they wanted. Other parts were snarls of tents and semi-permanent wooden structures. Central to the layout was the enormous well. Kaladin wasn't high enough to see over the buildings and make it out, but he knew the location. The Edge Dancer Clinic was nearby, though it was now staffed by ordinary surgeons. He hoped his parents and little brother had made it safely there, where the other surgeons would hide. They'd checked a few days back and found his father's clinic empty. Storms if he lost his family.
"The pursuer," Syl said. "He was waiting by the other entrance."
Kaladin reacted just in time, deactivating the Fabrial and dropping to the ground where he tucked and rolled. The relentless fuse appeared from his ribbon of light and dropped to the ground too, but Kaladin rolled to his feet out of the creature's reach.
"Your death,"
the creature growled, crouched among terrified market-goers, "is growing tedious, Windrunner. How is it you recovered all of your lashings?" Kaladin launched himself into the air, activating the device and shooting upward. It jerked his arm painfully, but he'd grown used to that, and Stormlight worked to heal the soreness. He'd also practiced his old one-handed spear grips. Hopefully that training would serve him today. He wasn't nearly as maneuverable with this device as he was with lashings. Indeed, as the pursuer gave chase as a ribbon, Kaladin's only real recourse was to cut the device and drop past him. Near the ground, Kaladin pointed his hand to the side and re-engaged the device, then went shooting out across the crowd in the general direction of the well. Maybe he lurched to a stop as the first of the device's weights bottomed out. A heartbeat later, the pursuer slammed into him, grabbing him around the neck and hanging on.
"Kaladin!" Syl shouted. "Heavenly ones! Over 12 of them! They're streaming in through the tunnels!"
"Good!" Kaladin said with a grunt, dropping his spear and grappling against the pursuer with the hand he could move.
"Good?"
she asked. He couldn't both grapple and twist the dial on his Fabrial, the one that would activate the second weight. But he could deactivate the device using one hand, so he did that, dropping them 10 feet to the ground. The pursuer hit first with a grunt. He hung on, though, rolling Kaladin to try to pin him.
"Turn the dial,"
Kaladin said to Syl, using both hands to struggle with the pursuer.
"When you die," the creature said in his ear, "I will find the next radiant your spren bonds and kill them too, as payment for the trouble you have given me."
Syl zipped down to his left wrist and took the shape of an eel, pushing against the raised section at the center of the dial. She could turn a page, lift a leaf. Would she be strong enough to click? Kaladin twisted in the pursuer's grip, barely managing to press his left hand to the creature's armored chest. Activating the device sent them both moving upward, but slowly. Storms, Kaladin hadn't thought this through. He'd only be able to lift as much as the counterweight. Apparently he and the pursuer together were about that heavy. Fortunately, rather than taking advantage of the slow movement, the pursuer paused and glanced at Kaladin's hand, trying to figure out what was happening. So as they inched upward, Kaladin was able to rip his right hand free. He reached for the scalpel he'd affixed in a makeshift sheath at his belt, then brought it up and rammed it into the pursuer's wrist, slicing the tendons there. The creature immediately let go, vanishing, leaving a husk behind. Once that dropped off of Kaladin, he immediately went darting up into the sky, pulled by his hand in an awkward motion that nearly ripped his arm from its socket.
"This isn't that effective, is it?" Syl asked.
"No," Kaladin said, slowing himself by relaxing his grip. He went to draw in more stormlight, but realized he still had plenty raging in his veins. That was one advantage of the Fabrial. He didn't use up light nearly as quickly. The Heavenly Ones circled him in the air, but kept their distance. Kaladin searched for the pursuer. The creature had used two bodies. He had a third one to waste before the fight became dangerous for him, so he wouldn't retreat yet. There, Kaladin thought, noting the red ribbon weaving between Heavenly Ones. The motions looked timid, uncommitted, and Kaladin took a moment to figure out why. The pursuer was trying to delay Kaladin. Each moment wasted was another one that might lead to the sibling being corrupted. Below, the market streets were quickly emptying of people. Kaladin's fears about them revolting weren't being realized, fortunately, but he couldn't spend forever in a standoff with the pursuer. So he disengaged the device and started falling. This finally made the pursuer dart for him, and Kaladin quickly re-engaged the device, lurching to a halt. He twisted, though he couldn't move his left arm, and prepared his knife. This sudden motion made the pursuer back off, however. Could the creature be afraid? That seemed implausible. Kaladin didn't have time to reflect, as he needed to engage the pursuer a third time for his plan to work. So he turned away, inviting the attack, and receiving it as the pursuer committed, darting in and forming a body that grabbed for Kaladin. Despite trying to speed away, Kaladin wasn't quite able to evade the creature's grip. Kaladin was forced to let the pursuer grab him around the neck as he stabbed the creature in the arm between two plates of carapace, trying to sever the tendons. The monster grunted, his armor on Kaladin's throat. They continued to soar about 30 feet off the ground. Kaladin ignored the tight grip and maneuvered the scalpel. Perhaps if he could force the pursuer to waste voidlight healing. Yes. Cut enough times to be worried, the pursuer let go and flew away, seeking a place to recover. Panting, Kaladin used the device to drop to the ground. He landed on an empty street between two tents. People huddled inside both, crowding them. Kaladin forced himself to jog to where he'd dropped his spear. Heavenly Ones circled above, preparing to attack. Syl moved up beside him, watching them. 2 dozen now. Kaladin searched them, hoping. There! He raised his spear toward Leshwi, who hovered apart from the others, wearing clothing too long for practical battle, even in the air. This event had caught her unaware. Please, he thought, accept the fight. That was his best hope. He couldn't fight them all at once. He could barely face the pursuer. If he wanted any chance of getting to the node, he'd need to fight a single opponent, one who wasn't as relentless as the pursuer. He worried he'd already wasted too much time. But if he could get Leshwe to agree to a duel, she raised her spear toward him. Syl, he said, go to the well and find the Fabrial of the node. It's probably a sapphire, and should have a glass sphere nearby like the one we saw before. Right, she said. It will probably be underwater. That's what the sibling said. Near the pump mechanisms. Can you swim? Won't need to, with stormlight to sustain me and the Fabrial to move me, Kaladin said, lifting his hand and rising into the air above the market. But the well is likely under heavy guard. Our best chance to destroy the Fabrial will be for me to break from this fight and fly straight down to it, then hit the device in one blow before anyone realizes what I'm doing. I'll need you to guide me.
Sounds good.
She hesitated, looking toward him. I'll be all right, he promised. She flew off to do as he requested. He might be too late already. He could feel something changing. A greater oppression, a heaviness, was settling upon him. He could only assume it was the result of the fused corrupting the sibling. But he couldn't move in that direction until Syl had the way prepared for him, so this would have to do. He leveled out in the air opposite Leshwe, his hand still held upward above him. The pose made him look overly dramatic, but he tried to appear confident anyway. Leshwe wore the same body as last time, muscular, tall, wrapped in flowing black and white clothing. Her lance was shorter than normal, perhaps intended for indoor fighting. Right. Well, he hoped to give a good showing in this fight, long enough to give Syl time to scout for him. so he cut the fabrial and dropped in the air, spinning and giving himself a few seconds of free fall. He felt almost like a real windrunner, which was dangerous as he almost tried to sculpt his fall with hands in the wind. Fortunately, he remembered to engage the device as he neared the rooftops. He lurched to a stop with a painful jolt, his arm bent, his elbow held close to his side. He had the most stability this way, his muscles keeping him as if he were standing upright with his left arm tucked in to keep his center of gravity close and tight. He gripped the device's bar and his left hand tugged him forward, zooming over the roofs of the shops. It made for a pitiful approximation of a true windrunner maneuver, but Leshwe dove after him anyway, echoing their previous contests. Eyes watering from the pain in his arm, Kaladin dropped to a rooftop and spun to raise his spear toward Leshwe, gripping it firmly in his right hand, a classic formation grip, with the spear up beside his head. "Heal," he thought at his arm, as Leshwe slowed above, holding her lance in one hand and hovering. She was plainly cautious, so Kaladin infused a patch of the rooftop with a reverse lashing, picturing it pulling on tassels of clothing. Leshwe's robes rippled and were pulled toward Kaladin, but she took a knife from her belt and cut them, dropping her train and much of the excess clothing to flutter down to affix itself to the rooftop. Kaladin raised himself into the air again, wincing at the pain in his shoulder.
"What is wrong, Windrunner?" Leshwe asked in heavily accented Alethi, coming closer. "Your powers fail you."
"Fight me anyway," Kaladin called up at her. As he did, he caught a glimpse of the pursuer's blood-red ribbon weaving out of a building below. Leshwe followed his gaze and seemed to understand, for she raised her lance toward him in an attack posture. Kaladin took a deep breath and returned his spear to the overhand grip, weapon up by his head, his elbow cocked. He'd been trained in this grip for shield and spear combat. It was best with a group of friends, each with shields up. But what combat wasn't? He waited for her to get close, then stabbed at her, causing her to dodge away. The pursuer's ribbon fluttered around nearby, weaving between watching heavenly ones. Leshwe made a few more token attempts to engage him, and for a moment the fight seemed almost fair. Then Leshwe rose into the air and passed overhead, while Kaladin was left to twist, then disengage his device and drop a few feet before lurching into a hanging position, facing her. She cocked her head, then flew to the side and attacked him from that direction. He tried to deflect, but he was too immobile. Her spear bit him in the left arm, causing him to grunt in pain. Blood spread from the wound, and, as before, it didn't heal immediately. In fact, his stormlight seemed to be responding slower than it had earlier in this fight. Storms, this had been a mistake. He couldn't duel Leshwe like this. He'd be better off on the ground. He'd be outmatched against opponents with the high ground, but at least he wouldn't be frozen in place. If Navani ever wanted these devices to be useful in aerial combat, she had a lot of work to do. So he fled, engaging the device and sending himself flying between a couple of heavenly ones who moved dutifully to the sides to let Leshwe follow. Even the pursuer seemed to respect the duel, as his ribbon stopped following and vanished below. At least that part of Kaladin's plan had worked. Unfortunately, Leshwe had clearly put together that he couldn't veer to either side, and that his acceleration was limited to a single lashing, the maximum from one falling weight. So while he crossed the vast room in seconds, the moment he slowed to prevent himself from hitting the wall, she slammed into him from behind. The force of the hit made him grip the speed control bar by accident, and he was rammed into the wall by his own fist, Leshwe pressing him from behind. She put a knife to his neck.
"This is a sham, Stormblessed," she said in his ear. "This is no contest."
He squeezed his eyes shut, fighting off the pain of the hit and the cut to his arm, though that finally appeared to be healing. Slowly, but at least it was happening.
"We could drop to the ground," he said through gritted teeth. "Fight a duel without surges."
"Would you actually do that?" Leshwe said. "I think you cannot spare the time. You're here to interfere with whatever the Lady of Wishes is doing."
Kaladin grunted his reply, not wanting to waste Stormlight by speaking. Leshwe, however, pulled away in the air, leaving him to turn around awkwardly as he'd done before, with a dropping lurch. She drifted down to eye level with him. Past her, he spotted Syl rising into the air and coming toward him. She made a quick glyph in the air. Ready. As Leshwe started talking, he fixed his attention on her so she wouldn't think anything was amiss.
Surrender, she said. If you give your weapon to me now, I might be able to get the Lady of Wishes to turn aside the pursuer. Together we could start to work toward a true government and peace for Roshar.
A true government and peace? Kaladin demanded. Your people are in the middle of conquering mine.
And did your leader not conquer his way to the throne? She asked, sounding genuinely confused. This is the way of your people as well as mine. Besides, you must admit my people govern better. The humans under our control have not been treated unfairly. Certainly they live better than the singers fared under your domination.
And your god? Kaladin asked. You can promise me that once humankind has been subdued, he won't have us exterminated?
Leshwe didn't respond, though she hummed to a rhythm he couldn't distinguish.
I know the kind of men who follow Odium, Kaladin said softly. I've known them all my life. I bear their brands on my forehead, Leshwe. I could almost trust you for the honor you've shown me, if it didn't mean trusting him as well.
She nodded and seemed to accept this as a valid argument. She began lowering, perhaps to engage in that fight he'd suggested, without powers.
Leshwe, he called after she had lowered partway. I feel the need to point out that I didn't agree to fight you below. I simply noted it was an option.
What is the distinction? She called up.
I'd rather you not see this as a broken oath, he said,
then disengaged the fabrial and pointed it right at Syl before launching himself that direction, straight over Leshwe's head. He didn't wait to see if she gave chase. Syl streaked ahead of him, leading him straight across the room toward the blue pool of water at the center. Guards were there, pushing people into buildings, but the way was open. The other heavenly ones kept their distance from him, assuming he was still dueling with Leshwe. He cut the fabrial right as he passed over the well, then pointed his hand down and engaged it. His aim was true, and he sucked in more stormlight as he splashed into the water. It hurt to hit, far more than he'd expected from something soft like water. His arm kept pulling him downward, though, despite the resistance. It quickly grew dark, and a part of him panicked at never having been this far beneath water before. His ears reacted oddly, painfully. Fortunately, his stormlight sustained him in the chill depth. It also gave him light to see a figure below, swimming beside a group of glowing gemstones on the wall, secured here deep beneath the surface. The figure turned toward him, her topknot swirling in the water, lit from the side by a variety of gemstone hues. It was her. The one who had been so fascinated with him last time. This time she seemed surprised, drawing a dagger from her belt and swinging it at him. However, Kaladin found that Navani's fabrial worked far better in this environment. He could easily disengage it and swing it in another direction without dropping or lurching, and the added pull meant he easily outmaneuvered this fused. He spun around her and moved lower in the water. The well's shaft was only about 10 feet wide, so when she pushed off a wall, she could reach him, but behind her, Syl highlighted the correct gemstone. He engaged his own fabrial, which towed him past the fused, letting her get a clean cut across his chest with her dagger. Blood clouded the water, but Kaladin connected his fist against the sapphire, knocking it free. He spun his spear in the water and jabbed it at the wires of the fabrial cage, then pried loose the glass sphere. That should do it. Now to get out. He looked upward through the red water and began to feel dizzy. Healing was coming so slowly. Syl soared ahead of him as he used the fabrial to rise up, leaving the annoyed fused behind. Syl's light was encouraging as it seemed to be getting darker in here. My stormlight is running out. Storms. How was he going to get away? Dozens of fused awaited him above. He might have to surrender, as Leshwe had insisted. Would they let him now? What was that rumbling? He saw light shimmering above, but it was shrinking. Syl made it out, but she didn't seem to have realized he was lagging behind her, and the light was vanishing. A lid, he realized with panic. They're putting a lid over the top of the well. As he neared, in the last sliver of light, he saw the hulking form of the pursuer, smiling. The lid thumped in place right before Kaladin arrived. He burst into the small section of air between the top of the well's water level and the lid, gasping for breath. But he was trapped. He slammed against the wood, trying to use the power of Navani's device to lift it. But he heard thumping as weights, likely stones, were set on top of it. More and more of them. The pursuer had been ready for this. He knew that even if Kaladin's gravitational lashings worked, enough weight would keep the lid in place. In fact, it felt like the weights were alive. People, dozens of them, climbing on top of the lid. Of course, why use stone when humans were heavy enough and far easier to move? Kaladin pounded on the wood as he felt Syl panicking, unable to reach him. His stormlight was fading, and it seemed the walls and the lid were closing in on him. He'd die in here, and it wouldn't take long. All the pursuer had to do was wait. They could seal it above, denying him fresh air. In that moment of pure terror, Kaladin was in one of his nightmares again. Blackness, encircled by hateful shadows, trapped. Anxiety mounted inside him, and he began to thrash in the water, screaming, letting out the rest of his stormlight. In that moment of panic, he didn't care. But as he fell hoarse from shouting, he heard, strangely enough, Hav's voice. Kaladin's old sergeant from his days as a recruit.
Panic on the battlefield kills more men than enemy spears. Never run. Always retreat.
This water came from somewhere. There was another way out. Kaladin took a deep breath and dove beneath the black water, feeling it surround him. His panic returned. He didn't know which way was up and which was down. How could you forget which way the sky was? But all was blackness. He fished in his pouch, finally managing to think clearly. He got out a glowing gemstone, but it slipped from his fingers and sank. That way. He pointed his fist toward the falling light and engaged Navani's device. He was in no state for delicacy, so he squeezed as tight as he could and lurched, towed by his arm farther into the darkness. He plunged past the fabrials and the fused. She was swimming upward and didn't seem concerned with him. His ears screamed with a strange pain the deeper he went. He started to breathe in more stormlight, but stopped himself. Underwater, he risked getting a lungful of liquid. But he had no idea how to get light when submerged. How had they never thought about this? It was good that the device kept pulling him because he might not have had the presence of mind to keep moving on his own. That was proven as he reached the gemstone he'd dropped, a garnet, and found it sitting on the bottom of the tube. A bright sapphire glowed here too, the one he'd knocked free. He grabbed it and disengaged the gauntlet fabrial, but it took him precious seconds to think and search around. The tunnel turned level here. He moved in that direction, engaging the device, letting it pull him. His lungs started to burn. He was still surviving on the breath he'd taken above and didn't know how to get more stormlight. He was still trailing blood as well. Was that light ahead? Or was his vision getting so bad that he was seeing stars? He chose to believe it was light. When he reached it, more fabrial pumps, he shut off his fabrial, pointed his hand upward, and engaged the device again. Nightmares chased him, manifestations of his anxiety, and it was as if the world were crushing him. Everything became blackness once more. The only thing he felt was Syl, so distant now, terrified. He thought that would be his last sensation. Then he broke out of the water into the air. He gasped, a raw and primal action, a physiological response rather than conscious choice. Indeed, he must have blacked out anyway, for when he blinked and his senses returned, he found himself hanging by his aching arm from the ceiling in a reservoir beneath the tower. He shook his head and looked at his hand. He'd dropped the sapphire, and when he tried to breathe in stormlight, nothing came. His pouch was empty of it. He must have fed off it while drifting in and out of consciousness. He was tempted to let himself sleep again. No, they'll be coming for you. He forced his eyes open. If the enemy had explored the tower enough to know about this reservoir, they would come looking to be certain he was dead. He disengaged the fabrial and dropped into the water. The cold shocked him awake, and he was able to use the fabrial to tuck himself to the side of the reservoir. He crawled out onto dry stone. Amusingly, he was enough of a surgeon to worry about how he'd contaminated this drinking water. Of all the things to think about right now. He wanted to sleep, but could see blood dripping from his chest and arm, the wounds there not fully healed.
so he stumbled to the side of the chamber and sucked the stormlight from the two lamps there. Yes, the enemy knew about this place. If he hadn't been so addled, he'd have put together earlier that the light meant someone was changing the gemstones. He stumbled, sodden and exhausted, down the hallway. There would be an exit. He vaguely remembered news of Navani's scouts finding this reservoir. They'd only known about it by having Thalen freedivers inspect the fabrials in the well. Keep thinking. Keep walking. Don't drift off. Where was Syl? How far was he from her now? He'd traveled quite a way in the darkness of that water. He reached steps, but couldn't force himself to climb them. He just stood, numb, staring at them. So he used the fabrial. Slow, easy climbs with it, tugging him up at one angle, then another, back and forth, again and again. He knew he was close when he heard rumbling. The high storm. It was still blowing, so he hadn't been in that blackness for an eternity. He let it call to him as he continued half-flying, half-trudging upward. Finally, he staggered out of a room on the ground floor of the tower. He emerged right into the middle of a group of Singer troops shouting for people to go to their quarters. The storm rumbled in the near distance. Several of the soldiers turned toward him. Kaladin had a moment of profound disconnect, as if he couldn't believe he was still alive, as if he'd thought that trudge up the stairwell had been his climb to the Tranquiline Halls. Then one of the guards leveled a spear at him, and Kaladin's body knew what to do. Exhausted, wounded, nerves worn all the way to damnation, Kaladin grabbed that spear and twisted it out of the man's hand, then swept the legs of the next soldier. A few regals not far off shouted, and he caught sight of a heavenly one, not Leshwi, rising into the air and pointing a lance at him. They weren't through with him yet. He turned and ran, holding that stolen spear, drawing in stormlight from lanterns, but feeling it do nothing at all to heal him. Even the slow healing from before had apparently stopped working. Either he'd further undermined his powers somehow by destroying the fabrial, or, more likely, the sibling was too far gone toward corruption. Chased by dozens of soldiers, Kaladin ran for the storm. Though it was dangerous outside, at least the enemy would have difficulty finding him in the tempest. He couldn't fight them. The only way to escape was to do something truly desperate. He reached the front entryway of the tower, where winds coursed in through a portal that might once have held a wooden gate. They'd never taken the time to put in a new one. Why would they? The storms rarely reached this high. Today they had. Today Kaladin reached the winds. And like everything else today, they tried their best to kill him. 71. Rider of Storms. Voice of Lights. Voice for Lights. If I speak for the lights, then I must express their desires. If light is investiture, and all investiture is deity, and deity has intent, then light must have intent. From Rhythm of War, final page. Dalinar no longer feared high storms. It had been some time now since he'd worried that he was mad. Yet, as a poorly treated horse learned to flinch at the mere sound of a whip, something had persisted inside of Dalinar. A learned response that a storm meant losing control. So it was with a deep and satisfying sense of relief that today Dalinar realized he didn't fear the storm. Indeed, when Elphabar listed the time of today's storm, Dalinar felt a little surge of excitement. He realized he felt more awake on high storm days, more capable. "Is that you?" he asked of the Stormfather.
"It is us," the Stormfather replied. "Me and you. I enjoy passing over the continent as it gives me much to see. But it also tires me, as it energizes you."
Dalinar stepped away from the table and dismissed his attendants and scribes, who had finished briefing him on the latest intelligence regarding Urethiru. He could barely control his mounting concern about Navani and the tower. Something was wrong. He could feel it in his bones. So he'd begun looking for options. The current plan was for him to lead an expedition into Shadesmar, sail to the tower, then open up a perpendicularity to let spies in. Unfortunately, they didn't know if it would work. Would he even be able to activate a perpendicularity in the area? He had to try something. The latest letters from Navani, although they did contain her passcodes, felt unlike her. Too many delays, too many assurances she was fine. He'd ordered a team of workers to begin clearing the rubble that prevented his scouts from entering through the basement. That would reportedly take weeks, and shard blades couldn't be summoned in the region, being suppressed like fabrials and radiant powers. He pressed his palm flat against the table, gritting his teeth. He ignored the stack of reports from the front lines. Jasna and the others were handling the war, and he could see their victory approaching. It wasn't inevitable, but it was highly likely. He should be focusing on his bondsmith training, but how could he? He wanted to find a set of plate, borrow a blade, and go march to the battlefront and find someone to attack. The idea was so tempting, he had to acknowledge how much he'd come to depend on emotional support from the thrill of battle. Storms, sometimes he longed so powerfully for the way he'd felt alive when killing. Such emotions were remarkably similar to what he'd felt upon giving up the drink. A quiet, anxious yearning that struck at unexpected moments, seeking the pleasure, the reward. He couldn't blame everything he'd done on the thrill. That had been Dalinar in those boots, holding that weapon and glorying in destruction. That had been Dalinar lusting to kill. If he let himself go out and fight again, he knew he'd realize a part of him still loved it. And so he had to remain here, find other ways of solving his problems. He stepped out of his personal dwelling, another small stone hut in Laki, their command city. He took a deep breath, hoping the fresh air would clear his mind. The village was now fully fortified against both storms and attacks, with high-flying scout posts watching the land all around and windrunners darting in to deliver reports. I must get better with my powers, Dalinar thought. If I had access to the map I could make with Shallan, we might be able to see exactly what is happening at Urethiru.
It would not help, the Stormfather said in his mind, a sound like distant thunder. I cannot see the tower. Whatever weakens the Windrunners when they draw close weakens me too, so the map would not reveal the location. However, I could show it to you. Perhaps you can see better than I.
Show me, Dalinar asked, causing Zeth, his omnipresent shadow, to glance at him.
How? You can ride the storm with me, the Stormfather said. I have given others this privilege on occasion.
Ride the storm with you? Dalinar said.
It is like the visions that Honor instructed me to grant, only it is now. Come, see.
Martra, Dalinar said, looking to the scribe who'd been assigned to him today.
I might act odd for a short time. Nothing is wrong, but if I'm not myself when my next appointment begins, please make them wait.
Yes, Bright Lord, she said, hugging her ledger, eyes wide. Should I, get you a chair?
That would be a good idea, Dalinar said.
He didn't feel like being closed up inside. He liked the scent of the air, even if it was too muggy here, and the sight of the open sky. Martra returned with a chair, and Dalinar settled himself, facing eastward, toward the origin, toward the storms, though his view was blocked by the large stone stormbreak.
Stormfather, he said, I'm...
He became the storm. Dalinar soared along the front of the storm wall like a piece of debris. No, like a gust of wind blowing with the advent of the storm. He could see, comprehend, far more than when he'd flown under Windrunner power. It was a great deal to take in. He surged across rolling hills with plants growing in the valleys between them. From high up, it looked like a network of brown islands, surrounded by greenery, each and every lowland portion filled to the brim with a snarl of underbrush. He'd never seen anything quite like it, the plants unfamiliar to him, though their density did faintly remind him of the valley where he had met cultivation. He didn't have a body, but he turned and saw that he towed a long shadow, the storm itself.
"When the Windrunner flew on my winds, he zipped about," the Stormfather said, and Dalinar felt the sounds all around him. "You simply think. You complain about meetings, but you are well suited to them."
"I grow," Dalinar said. "I change. It is the mark of humanity, Stormfather, to change. A prime tenet of our religion. When I was Kaladin's age, I suspect I would have acted as he."
"We approach the mountains," the Stormfather said. "Urethivu will come soon. Be ready to watch."
A mountain range started to grow up to Dalinar's right, and he realized where they must be, blowing through Triax, or Tufalia, countries with which he had little experience. These weren't the mountains where he'd find Urethiru, not yet. So he experimented with motion, soaring closer to the overgrown valleys. Yes, this landscape was alien to him, the way the underbrush snarled together so green, full of grass, broadleaves, and other stalks, all woven together with vines and bobbing with lifespren. The vines were a netting tying it all together, tight against storms. He saw curious animals with long tentacles for arms and leathery skin instead of chitin. Malleable, they easily squeezed through holes in the underbrush and found tight pockets in which to hide as the storm wall hit. Strange that everything would be so different when it wasn't that far from Alethkar. Only a little trip across the Tarat Sea. He tried to hang back to inspect one of the animals.
"No," the Stormfather said. "Forward, ever forward."
Dalinar let himself be encouraged onward, sweeping across the hills until he reached a place where the underbrush had been hollowed out to build homes. These valleys weren't so narrow or deep that flooding would be a danger, and the buildings were built on stilts a few feet high anyway. They were grown over by the same vine netting, the edges of the buildings melding with the underbrush to borrow its strength. Once, this village had likely been in an enviable location, protected by the surrounding plants. Unfortunately, as he blew past, he noted multiple burned-out buildings, the rest of the village in shambles. The Everstorm. Dalinar's people had adopted to it. Large cities already had walls on all sides, and small villages had been able to rely upon their government's stockpiles to help them survive this change in climate. But small, isolated villages like this had taken the brunt of the new storm with nobody to help. How many such places existed on Roshar, hovering on the edge of extinction? Dalinar was past the place in a few heartbeats, but the memory lingered. Over the last 2 years, what cities and towns hadn't been broken by the sudden departure of the Parshmen had been relentlessly attacked by storm or battle. If they won, when they won the war, they would have a great deal of work to do in rebuilding the world. As he continued his flight, he saw something else discouraging, a pair of foragers trapped while making their way back toward their home. The ragged men huddled together in a too shallow ravine. They wore clothing of thick woven fibers that looked like the rug material that came out of Marat, and their spears weren't even metal.
"Take mercy upon them," Dalinar said. "Temper your fury, Stormfather." "It is not fury, it is me."
"Then protect them," Dalinar said as the storm wall hit, plunging the ill-fated men into darkness.
"Should I protect all who venture out into me?"
"Yes."
"Then do I stop being a storm? Stop being me?"
"You can be a storm with mercy."
"That defies the definition and soul of a storm," the Stormfather said. "I must blow. I must make this land exist. I carry seeds, I birth plants, I make the landscape permanent with creme. I provide light. Without me, Roshar withers.
I'm not asking you to abandon Roshar, but to protect those men, right here, right now.
Aye, the Stormfather rumbled. It is too late. They did not survive the storm wall. A large boulder crushed them soon after we began speaking.
Dalinar cursed, an action that translated as crackling lightning in the nearby air.
How can a being so close to divinity be so utterly lacking in honor? I am a storm. I cannot...
You are not merely a storm, Dalinar bellowed, his voice changing to rumbles of thunder.
You are capable of choice. You hide from that, and in so doing, you are a coward.
The Stormfather did not respond. Dalinar felt him there, subdued, like a petulant child scolded for their foolishness. Good. Both Dalinar and the Stormfather were different from what they had once been. They had to be better. The world demanded that they be better. Dalinar soared up higher, no longer wanting to see specifics, in case he was to witness more of the Stormfather's unthinking brutality. Eventually, they reached snow-dusted mountains, and Dalinar soared to the very top of the storm. Lately, the storms had been creeping higher and higher in the sky, something people wouldn't normally notice, but which was